It's Wednesday, February 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, military strategy and condemnation in Syria. Tough and productive talk at the ASEAN summit. The Pope visits with Mexico's poor.
In every trial we've done, we've reduced the Aedes aegypti mosquito population by over 90% in about 6 months.
Controlling the mosquito-borne Zika virus with mosquitoes. Also ahead, growing up Chinese in South Africa. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Turkey called on Tuesday for a ground operation with its international allies to end the war in Syria as the United Nations announced aid convoys are being sent to the besieged towns. In Damascus, UN envoy Staffan de Mistura announced that aid convoys will be sent today to test the resolve of warring parties to allow in humanitarian supplies. Meanwhile, a Turkish official told reporters in Istanbul that his country is pushing for ground operations in Syria, hoping for the involvement of the United States and other allies against the Islamic State group. But he ruled out the possibility of Turkey undertaking unilateral action or the prospect of a joint Saudi-Turkey venture. The UN, European Union, and United States, meanwhile, have condemned attacks in northern Syria Monday that damaged or destroyed hospitals, one operated by the French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, and schools, killing nearly 50 people, including children. U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice.
What concerns us is that as the violence continues, more and more civilians are being impacted. And the pressure on civilians and the outflow of displaced persons from their areas of residence is increasing. And that is why we have put a premium on trying to halt the violence, enable humanitarian access, and create an environment that is conducive for a political track to get underway.
The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the attacks were carried out by Russian warplanes in support of the forces of President Bashar al-Assad. We turn now to one of the big stories being reflected today on social media. Following that is G. Abby Lee in the studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So what are some of the ASEAN leaders saying online about the summit?
Many leaders tweeted their arrival to the United States almost real time. Philippine President Noynoy Aquino posted a picture of him and President Obama on Twitter. His handle is @NoynoyAquino. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak also tweeted his arrival in Bahasa Melayu. Translation of his tweet reads like this: I attended the summit retreat session of the U.S. ASEAN leaders. His full name is Muhammad Najib Tun Razak, but his handle is simply Najib Razak.
Well, that's much easier to remember. Tell us one more.
Sure. Lee Hsien Loong is the Prime Minister of Singapore and tweets in English. His handle is his full name. The Prime Minister's office manages the account, but the tweets by Lee are signed LHL. And Tuesday's tweet is signed with an initial. It reads like this: Happy to meet President Obama again today to build an ASEAN-U.S. strategic partnership.
Lee has been in America for some days now, right?
Exactly. He was visiting San Francisco to meet with IT industry insiders, and the list of the people he met is quite impressive. He met with Elon Musk of Tesla, Google CEO Sundar Pichai, and its former CEO Eric Schmidt. He also met with Apple CEO Tim Cook.
Quite a lineup. Well, turning back to the United States, did the U.S. mission to ASEAN tweet about the summit today?
They did. The account tweeted a link to its page on President Obama's remarks at the opening session of the U.S.-ASEAN summit. And if you're interested, you can check out the account at U.S. Mission to ASEAN with the number 2 in Arabic number. Now, just like yesterday, the best hashtag to use to keep posted on the event is #U.S.-ASEAN2016. Back to you.
Well, thanks for the wrap-up, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson, and our program account is at VOA_IE. President Barack Obama called for tangible steps to lower tensions over ongoing territorial disputes in the South China Sea, following those talks with Southeast Asia leaders at a security and economic summit being held in California. Mr. Obama said the leaders affirmed that disputes should be resolved peacefully and through legal means. We're joined now by VOA White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas for more. The summit is at the Sunnylands Resort. The leaders are not wearing neckties, but in fact, the mood there has been very serious.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was scenic, it was beautiful, and the White House position is this will allow leaders to be more open, more relaxed. But the truth is they discussed some very, very serious issues, security issues. And one of the prominent things that came out of this is how to lower tensions in the South China Sea. So that is a very sensitive discussion. But that is one of the areas that President Obama says that they agreed needs attention, that tangible steps were needed to reduce tensions there.
It is a very thorny issue, many of these countries with competing claims in the South China Sea, and the president reiterating that the United States will basically sail or fly anywhere it pleases within the region.
Exactly. And so it's a very delicate balance that the U.S. has to walk as it seeks to engage these countries and also keep relations as good as possible with China, because these two superpowers have to work together. So the president made clear that the U.S. will continue freedom of navigation exercises there, and that it will continue to help allies like the Philippines build up their maritime capabilities. So this seems to be a direct response to more aggressive actions by Beijing in the South China Sea. So many of these countries do not want to see these superpowers at odds. They want to see everyone get along. And ASEAN, the White House says, is one reason why it would like to see these nations become centralized and adopt some sort of framework where they could all work within the law, peacefully, together, legally, with rules and norms that work for everybody.
What were some of the other points of discussion on the agenda for today?
Trade, commerce in particular, tapping into what is emerging in Southeast Asia, and that is these economies and these societies where you see a lot of really important innovation, a lot of knowledge-based skills. You see a lot of things that U.S. companies want to tap into. They want to be a part of, they want to work together. And so a lot of the discussion was also about how can we do that? They had business leaders come in and they said, look, we need more transparency. We need some rules to be able to operate there, and also some programs to bring your innovators in to work with us. It's tapping into the innovation, really, that's sort of emerging in Southeast Asia. So that was really exciting.
Very exciting component. And another interesting item that we heard, the president is planning to travel to Vietnam.
Yes, he's going to make two trips there this year. He's going to Laos and he's going to Vietnam. So this certainly speaks to countries that the U.S. wants to get closer to and also support in terms of their movement politically, what areas they're going in. And so that is one thing the White House has made clear. They're going to continue to engage more and more. I think we're seeing them move to countries that they haven't traveled to for a very long time, if at all. Laos will be the first time a U.S. sitting U.S. president visits that country. The president there is also the chair of ASEAN for next year. It's sort of reaching beyond this presidency to solidify and cement some relations with the U.S.
With the president at the ASEAN summit in California, our own Mary Alice Salinas, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
President Obama is seeking to develop a leadership role with ASEAN, which the White House sees as key to the U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Pope Francis is on the next to last day of his five-day visit to Mexico, and Tuesday was in the western state of Michoacán. It was gripped by rampant narcotics and drug trafficking, and there he met with young people and continued his theme of the pastoral role of the church. Chad Pecknold, a theology professor at the Catholic University of America in Washington, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Francis is continuing what he sees his role as the Pope to the poor.
I think what we saw was a papal masterclass on Jesuit missiology. Jesuits have always had this missionary strategy called enculturation, which is be as close to the people as possible, be as accommodating as possible to the culture you're evangelizing. And in Chiapas, we saw that. The Pope goes out of his way to embrace the indigenous traditions, to embrace them as compatible with the Catholic faith in order to show a closeness to the people.
Was this a challenge to the Mexican Catholic hierarchy that apparently has been somewhat distant from this culture?
This pope is always hardest on his own bishops. He told them not to waste time with careerism. He told them to be close to the poor. This is just something he says to all of his bishops. And here we see him leading by example to say to his bishops, I want you to take up this strategy of what he calls accompaniment, of coming alongside. Interestingly, in Chiapas, the Pope asked the indigenous for their forgiveness over their exclusion from society. Now, that's a very interesting way to speak on behalf of humanity, to offer the indigenous an apology that they would never hear from the Mexican government, that they would never hear from officials in Chiapas or indeed from Mexican society as a whole. But the Pope asked for forgiveness to bear witness to God's mercy as the very thing needed to heal that social brokenness that he sees in the indigenous people, these injustices that have been done to the indigenous people. Of course, this is something that is interesting also because the church has just celebrated the feast of the Dominican saint, Bartolomé de las Casas, who's famous for his 16th century defense of indigenous people. And surely the Pope is giving a nod to Las Casas in recognizing the indigenous people on this trip, recognizing, as de Las Casas did in the 16th century, that they have rights and that their rights come from God and that they must be treated with the same dignity as everybody else because they bear God's image too. And so by reaching out to the indigenous, he in a sense lifts up all the themes of his papacy, of accompaniment, of reaching out to the poor, of solidarity with human beings and recognizing them as children of God.
Before leaving Mexico, the Pope later today will visit the northern border city of Ciudad Juarez, where he will pray with migrants and the victims of violence. The World Health Organization says countries dealing with outbreaks of the mosquito-borne Zika virus should consider using controversial methods to fight its spread. One of those methods uses genetically modified mosquitoes to stop Zika-infected mosquitoes from breeding. The effort to develop these sterile male mosquitoes is being spearheaded by a British company named Oxitec. Reporting for International Edition, Ira Melman spoke to Oxitec CEO Hayden Perry about the effectiveness of the mosquito project.
Remarkably so, actually. I mean, we've been pioneering this for the last few years. So we've actually got field trial data, you know, using this outdoors in urban environments since 2009. In every trial we've done, and by trial, what I actually mean is we're releasing our mosquitoes in an urban environment. In every trial we've done, we've reduced the Aedes aegypti mosquito population by over 90% in about 6 months.
So by 90%, that is quite amazing. But as you know, there is opposition. Environmentalists have cautioned against the use of GMO mosquitoes, saying the long-term effects of killing off an entire insect population is unknown. About 150,000 people recently signed a petition against the use of the GMO mosquito. What do you say to these people?
Well, I think it's very important to understand exactly what we do. Now, people have a conception of genetic modification, and it largely comes from the use of genetically modified crops. And the normal perception is that if you're going to use something that's genetically modified, I'll put that in inverted commas, that you're putting a new gene or you're putting something into the environment that stays there and will spread and replicate. And that indeed is what most people think when you talk to them about this. But actually, with our system, it's the complete opposite. Every single one of our mosquitoes that we release will die in a few days. If they mate a female, then the offspring will die in a few days. Nothing stays in the environment. Nothing spreads. So actually, what you can do is you can control a mosquito population in a town without actually having any long-term effects in terms of the ecosystem. Because you're not spreading a gene, you're not, and nothing is staying in the environment. That's absolutely key. The other thing I'd mention here is that we actually use a color marker, which is quite unique, actually, which means that we can actually see, in effect, where our insects go. We can see where they're having an effect. We can predict how many we need to release. It's a system of constant monitoring and metrics and understanding the effect we're actually having. And I would contrast that to what people do at the moment, which is using insecticides, where you fog or spray, where not only do you affect all insect life, including beneficials, but you actually have no real idea what the effect you're having. You're just putting chemicals into the environment and hope that's having an effect. With our approach, it's very precise, very well monitored.
Oxitec CEO Hayden Perry. Immigrants have departed from and arrived to every country through the years, including Chinese settling in South Africa. Journalist Yufrida Ho grew up there after her father had made a daring and dangerous move in the 1950s. Ho has researched his life and struggle as a second-class citizen in a country embroiled in social unrest. In a fascinating and personal memoir titled Paper Sons and Daughters, she writes of her experiences growing up Chinese in South Africa.
I think what was really quite sad is a lot of people had no idea they were even coming to South Africa. There were just these golden mountains, the Gamsan as we call it in Cantonese, and as uneducated, illiterate people, they just got onto a boat. The exodus to some kind of promised land, you know, and South Africa was a hard choice. I think growing up, I did often question why South Africa. I wondered if my life would have been easier, and I guess because we have such a racially divided country and a country that attaches so much to what race means, I often wondered, I said, you know, would it have been easier to have been in an American or been an Australian or something like that? And it's still issues I think South Africa is grappling with about diversity and tolerance and, yeah, understanding that multiracial is not only applicable when it's convenient, it really is an ideal we should be striving for.
How difficult was it for you to chronicle your family's journey from China and dig into an often unclear history to ascertain the real story?
One of the sad things about writing the book was there are a lot of gaps for me around dates in particular. A lot of it, I guess, was what was literally handed down through conversations, through storytelling, because my family came from the villages. They were not educated. And I think the difficult thing was telling the stories. A lot of them, I guess, were very, really sad stories. I mean, you know, when I think of my grandparents being forced to marry two frightened virgins because of the Japanese invasion, the famine and the malnutrition that basically eventually claims my paternal granny's life. I mean, they become those ever-present ghosts in your life because they're no longer here with you, but you know them through the repeated stories, the stories you've heard over and over again. And it wasn't easy. I've got to be honest, it wasn't easy to write about a lot of those things.
Many Chinese immigrants returned home after a period of time or simply did not survive their ordeals in South Africa. For those who remained, what has been the experience trying to assimilate into South African society?
We see the presence of the Chinese more and more in the country, but yet I guess to a large extent the communities still remain very invisible. I think when I look at the Chinese South Africans, people who've been here for a couple of generations, my parents, whatever, it was convenient to actually hide behind, I guess, the representation of what it meant to be Chinese. So yes, we all do kung fu and we all do dragon dances, and you know, it's far easier to present the bow tie spring roll version of yourself than to really get stuck into some of the issues like job exclusion or stereotyping or prejudice.
Roughly, how many established Chinese families are there in South Africa, and how many are among the modern wave of immigrants?
Currently, we number around between 10 and 12,000. And then the newcomers, which I always think is really quite interesting, is when I last spoke to the Chinese embassy, they put the number, and I believe it's now closer to around 300,000. But what is always interesting for me is it's a number is between about 150,000 to 300,000. So again, it speaks about this enormous gap of who you can't account for. So again, another generation maybe of paper sons, another generation of people here who have to fly under the radar, the legal radar, to make a life in South Africa. So the unaccounted for is always huge and large.
Journalist Yefrida Ho, who writes in her book Paper Sons and Daughters about growing up Chinese in South Africa after her father emigrated there in the 1950s to seek a better life. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Music's annual Grammy Awards were handed out late Monday in Los Angeles, and arguably the biggest pop star around, Taylor Swift, made an appearance and, as expected, took home the award for Album of the Year. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London and International Edition's Susan Yockey are here in the studio to sing her praises.
We're going to talk about Taylor, who, in my opinion, was one of the better opening numbers for the Grammy. She sang her brand new single, which is Out of the Woods, which is the sixth release from her 1989 album. And she looked great. She had this sparkly one-piece bodysuit on and a short bob hair. She looked great. She really looked great. The confetti was flying. And it was a great opening to the show. And speaking of the 1989 album, that's the story, because the biggest award of the night, obviously, that everyone waits to find out, is the Album of the Year. And Taylor made history this year when she got it for the second time.
I wanted to ask you something, because you know this stuff. I read that the Grammys are kind of old because she wins so much. And they thought it was old stuff that she won, and they thought that the rap singer should have won.
Kendrick Lamar? Well, you know, there's different schools, different camps. People believe different things, and there will always be, you know, who should have won the Super Bowl.
Right.
You'll always get that, the factions of fans. And I don't think it's, you know, gotten boring or stale or predictable. She only got one Grammy, and so I think she deserved it. The 1989 album produced six hits. No other album has produced that many hits. And as I mentioned, the last time she did this was 2010. She was only 20 years old at the time. Her album Fearless won Album of the Year. She's the only female in Grammy history to do that, to win two Album of the Year Grammy Awards. The last time it was done, it was 1975. Stevie Wonder did it. So that's how rare it is, and that's how special this particular event was for Taylor Swift. And she gave a great acceptance speech.
Is she going to be like the Cher of her generation?
I don't know, because Taylor Swift is known not so much as a singer, although she is a singer. She's known as a songwriter. I think Cher is not really known as a songwriter.
No, no, no.
But Taylor Swift kind of writes great songs, and a lot of her great songs draw on personal events and experiences, including relationships. A lot of the songs talk about past relationships and leave us all guessing who was that one about?
I've heard she's a little sensitive about that, though.
Yes, she is. As a matter of fact, you know, she doesn't want to talk about her personal life too much. She's sensitive on a variety of subjects. You may remember at the MTV Awards in 2009, Kanye West grabbed the microphone out of her hand when she was accepting an award, and he said Beyonce had the video of the year. Well, Kanye West has a new song out called Famous that pokes fun of Taylor Swift, and he says he made Taylor Swift famous.
Oh.
And when she got her Best Album Grammy, she said, I want to just say for women all around the world and for artists all around the world, own it. It's yours. You deserve it. She said, I deserve this. No one else gets credit for this but me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Larry. And let's listen to her song, Blank Space.
Yes, this song was nominated for a Song of the Year.
Meet you where you been. I could show you incredible things. Magic, madness, heaven, sin. Saw you there and I thought, oh my God, look at that face. You look like my next mistake. Love's a game, wanna play. New money, suit and tie. I can read you like a magazine. Ain't it funny, rumors fly. And I know you heard about me, so hey, let's be friends. I'm dying to see how this one ends.
In addition to the incomparable Taylor Swift, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also out there on Twitter. We invite you to follow us at @VOA_IE. We also have a Facebook page you can check out, VOA Asia. It's for everybody. Stop by when you have a chance. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Nick Ivanoff. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us. Come back and visit again and have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The 22nd Amendment to the United States Constitution, ratified in 1951, states that no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. The amendment resolved an issue that Americans had debated since the founding of the Republic. Should there be a limit on the number of terms any individual can serve as President of the United States? The U.S. Constitution, as adopted in 1789, set no term limits for the office of the President. But many Americans feared that a popular leader, if continually reelected, might become corrupt or oppressive. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, was troubled by the Constitution's omission of term limits. The feature I dislike, he wrote, and greatly dislike, is the abandonment in every instance of the necessity of rotation in office, and most particularly in the case of the president. America's first president, George Washington, chose to limit his time in office to 2 terms. A precedent followed until the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt to a 3rd term in 1940 and a 4th term in 1944. His death in 1945, early in his 4th term, reignited the debate about the ability of persons continually reelected to the presidency to serve effectively. As President Barack Obama noted in his address at the African Union in July, South Africa's Nelson Mandela and America's George Washington forged a lasting legacy, not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. We'll be right back.
is for, what's your